If building a coop and having chickens run around your yard have been on your mind, today's Zesty Garden has a few ideas for you. Hello, I'm host Brian Earle, and today I'll talk with author Gretchen Anderson about her book, The Backyard Chicken Fight, how keeping chickens in your yard is ruffling feathers across the nation, and a beginner's guide to hen keeping. We'll look at everything from how to approach your neighbors about your new endeavor, how to find out what laws govern having chickens in your area, selecting the right breed of hen, and also how to take proper care of your new hobby. But first, you'll hear the first installment of Wait, Wait, Don't Plant That, as we talk about globe Navajo willows with USU Extension forestry specialist Mike Coons. Then, Nancy Williams enjoys asparagus in Petals and Prose, along with her recipe for asparagus and penne pasta. Stay tuned, the news is next.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Mountain West Bank, a community bank offering a variety of services and summer loan options for consumers at 110 South Main in Brigham City. Information at mountainwestbank.com. It's a division of Glacier Bank.
Hello, I'm your host Brian Earle, and this is The Zesty Garden, and we're starting out the program today talking with Gretchen Anderson. She's the author of The Backyard Chicken Fight, How Keeping Chickens in Your Yard is Ruffling Feathers Across the Nation, and A Beginner's Guide to Hen Keeping. And Gretchen is also a blogger with Mother Earth News, and she's in studio with us. And if you'd like to join our conversation, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. You can also send us an emailed question at zestygarden@gmail.com. Gretchen, thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
All right, so we had a lively conversation before the program about chickens, because apparently both you and I are passionate about chickens. So why write the book? What do you want to accomplish with it?
Well, it started way back in 2009 when I read an article out of The New Yorker where people had to fight for the right to keep chickens. And I was fascinated with that, that they were taking on their municipalities in order to keep a 3-pound hen in the backyard, you know, where other people are keeping potbelly pigs and that sort of thing. So I was fascinated with it. I started doing research, and it was happening everywhere across the country. And Brian, it is still happening today. People are fighting for that right. So that fascinated me. I talked to a lot of people across the country about their fights, and I chronicled the ones that were a little more poignant, humorous. I'm a humor writer, so, you know, those interested me. And put those stories into the book. And then I worked with our region's chicken expert, one of the chicken experts in our region. And he taught me everything he knows about chickens, which is really cool. I thought I knew a lot because I had chickens when I was a kid. But I learned that I did everything wrong when I was a kid. So it was a lot of fun. And then since the book came out in 2011, I've been all over the place promoting backyard chickens, so I become a national backyard chicken advocate, if there is such a word.
Now, you are a broadcast professional, and usually, and when I talk to people, they say, you work at a radio station, you have chickens? They don't seem to go together.
I think so. I think you're right. For me to be a former television news anchor at the NBC station in Boise, and now I'm promoting backyard chickens, people just can't wrap their brain around it, because, you know, they're used to seeing somebody who's, most of the time, I hope I'm poised with some makeup on and that sort of thing, and then they hear that I'm out there cleaning my chicken coop. It is a tough thing to wrap their brain around.
Okay, so at the beginning of the book, you have a lot of stories from people and their experiences with chickens. Why don't you relate a couple of those?
You know, by and large, across the country, people love their chickens. Once they get chickens, they just have to have them. And I think Brian, you know this. I said to my family once, I said, I know it sounds corny, but my chickens have brought me a lot of joy. And they looked at me and said, Mom, you got to get out more, you know. But my sister yesterday, we stayed with her, and she just lives right outside of Burley, and she had to rehome two of her chickens because they wanted to go do things this summer. And she said, Gretchen, I can't believe I got so attached to chickens. So, you know, it's those kind of stories. You get attached to your chickens.
Well, I didn't know I wanted chickens. When I was growing up, we had a little country store in Mendon, and the next door neighbors had chickens. One of them's name was Wild Bill. He pecked my legs. So that was my whole experience basically with chickens. And then when we moved into this house that we have, they could not catch one chicken when they moved. So they left it behind and said, "You have a chicken."
And the house comes with a chicken.
Yeah,
that's great.
And so we started taking care of this chicken. This chicken would come up and take food from us when we ate out on the lawn. I mean, we'd feed it to it. She was very gentle, and you get attached.
Yes,
and then we decided, okay, let's start looking at what friends that she can have. And so then I started getting the catalogs and looking through the catalogs. And then you start getting kind of overwhelmed. So why don't you address what's the best way to go about finding the right kind of breed for you, and do you go all out at the beginning, or is it better to just kind of gradually get into it?
I think a gradual, getting your toes wet is a good thing. I always recommend, Brian, that you get one of each breed. So if you're going to start out with four hens, and remember, chickens are flocking animals, you have to have at least two because they want to be together. They need a flock. So if you go for two or you go for four, make sure they're different breeds. And I recommend that because each breed will lay a different colored egg. And you and I kind of touched on that earlier before we went on the air. You can get a hen that lays a bright white egg. And you can get a hen that will lay, a Moran, an egg the color of a Hershey chocolate bar, that dark brown. And then everything in between, all the browns in between, and you can get some eggs that are blue and green and pink and speckled. There are so many different breeds. So get four different breeds, and then if one of them stops laying, you know something's up. You know she's either going into a molt where she changes her feathers, or she might be ill, and you'll have to address that. So you can directly track your hens' health through their egg production. And that's why I recommend different kinds of chickens.
So, but if you're trying to get the highest number of eggs, do you just get four different hens that are really good at egg production?
Sure, you could do that.
Because there are some hens that just, I mean, they lay eggs, but a Campine is not one I'm going to probably use for egg production,
right,
for instance.
Right. So. Rhode Island Red is known for its production. Those are the ones in the hen houses, in the factory farms for the brown eggs. And Leghorns are the white egg layers that are usually in the big farms as well. So if you get a Leghorn, and I would get a cross, I'd get a California, maybe a brown Leghorn, and I'd get a Rhode Island Red. And then, the Orpingtons are a wonderful breed.
Very gentle.
Yeah, the Barred Rocks. I love a Buckeye for several reasons. And I can't be without an Americana. The Americanas, Araucanas, they lay the blue and green eggs.
I also am the type of person that wants to have a chicken that nobody else has. So nobody else had Dominiques in the neighborhood, so I got a couple of Dominiques.
Cool, yeah.
Okay, I want to do a little side trip here. Mm-hmm. You said Leghorn.
Yeah.
And when I started getting chickens, I thought, Leghorn? Well, no, it's Foghorn Leghorn. So,
oh, Brian, you're singing my song. Mike Stanton is the wonderful chicken guru I worked with up in Idaho. And I called them Leghorns, too, because that's what I had as a kid. I had Leghorns. And he said, Gretchen, after we met a couple times, he says, Gretchen, they're Leghorns. You sound like a doofus. Don't call them Leghorns. I said, what about Foghorn? And he goes, no, they're Leghorns. Leghorns.
Warner Brothers just didn't get it right.
Oh, no. It had to sound like Foghorn, Leghorn, I guess. Leghorn is how you pronounce it, yeah.
Okay, so let's go to a coop. Mm-hmm. You've got to have some place for those chickens to roost at night. Hopefully you've got an area where the chickens can roam a little bit. You don't want to be known as your neighborhood commercial chicken grower. So you want to have them be able to get out and get to insects and eat grass and so forth. But you need a place for them to roost at night. So what do you have any plans that somebody can build from? Do you have any suggestions, websites people go to look for? What's the very basic that you need?
Plans for chicken coop building are all over the internet, and there's some wonderful plans. But what I always tell people, you're only limited by your imagination. So what you want to make sure is that you provide them with a coop that's secure from nocturnal predators, that will keep them safe and out of the wind, and that will be well-ventilated and not so much insulated. I know we get cold winters around here, but there are ways to keep your girls comfortable in the wintertime. So you talked about roosting and roaming. It's really important that your girls roost. You never want to go close up the coop at night and find your girls in the nesting box hanging out really cozy. You always want, unless they're trying to hatch out some eggs, you always want to pick them up out of the box and set them on the roost. Because what happens, and frankly speaking, is that they poop all night long, right? And you never want that to back up on their tail feathers, because then you'll have dirty eggs. And you don't want to have to wash that sanitary egg when it comes out. So make sure that they have a wonderful roost. And up here where we are in Logan, or whether you're talking Salt Lake or even up where I am in the Boise area, you get temperatures that are below zero. Mm-hmm. So you want to make sure that you give your girls a big, wide, flat roost. And I really highly recommend this. So a 2x4 is perfect, oriented on the four side, so that you jump up, the girls will jump up at night, they'll splay out their toes, and then they'll bring their breast feathers down over their toes at night.
And sit on,
and keep their feet warm. If any part of their toes are hanging out, you know, and not covered by their breast feathers, those toes are in jeopardy of getting frostbitten.
I've got some changes to make, because I just took the coop that was there when I moved in. I'm like, oh, they love it. They jump up on it, and it's basically like a 2x2.
And it's more like a dowel, and they hang on to it, and you don't want that. You want to give those big old girls, you know, a flat spot to roost. And people are surprised by this information, but it will protect their toes when they are docile, and that's overnight when the temperatures dip down very low, and then it's their combs and wattles you have to worry about in the wintertime in terms of frostbite. But you were talking about roaming as well. You want to make sure that they have about 8 square feet of roaming space and 4 square feet of cooping space. So
per chicken.
Yeah, per chicken. And so if you know, I've crammed a lot of chickens in my small coop, but then they free range during the day.
Yeah.
So in the coop itself, they got really cozy, which is fine. That's fine. But as long as they free range, they're good to go. The girls need to get out. They need sunshine. They need to do dust baths. If you don't have an area where they can go roll around in the dust, that's how they clean themselves. You need to provide that for them. That's essential, just as roosting and a coop that is, it keeps them out of the wind, but is well ventilated.
When I used to take chickens to the Cache County Fair, that's kind of where I was getting educated about, okay, you got to make sure they can do the dust baths, because that keeps the mites.
Oh, yes.
Keeps the mites down. I mean,
yes.
The chickens know what to do to help themselves.
Yes, they do. They do, and they're very good at it, and it's essential to their well-being. So, you know, cooping or versus free range, you know, if you free range your girls, they fertilize everything in their path. And that can be good and bad. So if you coop them or you keep them in a run, that's controlled, and that's a good thing, too. Just make sure they have plenty of space. If girls are all cooped up, quote-unquote, that saying, they'll start pecking at one another, and you don't want that.
Mm. So as far as the coop itself, you said that it's better for the movement of air rather than the warmth. Can you still, I'm feeling guilty, like I should insulate the coop a little bit. Now, it's open on the baffles, so there would still be, I think, air movement in there. Would that be okay?
Perfect, yes, okay. Absolutely. Make sure their feet are taken care of with a wide roost, and as long as they're out of the wind, remember, we see wild birds all year long. Even in the wintertime, they do just fine. They have their own little down coats on, both winter and summer. And the good news, Brian, is that chickens actually fare better in the wintertime than they do in the heat of the summer. They do better in the wintertime. So
even when it's sub-zero, it's better than having 80, 90, 100 degrees.
Absolutely. They can do just fine. And walking around in those cold temperatures, the nice thing about it is they're moving and they're keeping their blood circulating. It's the roosting at night that you have to be most concerned about. And making certain that there is no ammonia smell in your coop. I always tell people, they ask, you know, Gretchen, how often do I need to clean my coop? And because everybody has a different situation, I say, you put your head in the coop and it smells worse in the coop than it does outside, you got your answer.
Time to clean.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Whether you do, there's a deep litter method that a lot of people are fond of. Whatever you do, if it smells in the coop, you got to clean it out.
You're listening to The Zesty Garden. My guest is Gretchen Anderson. She's the author of The Backyard Chicken Fight, How Keeping Chickens in Your Yard is Ruffling Feathers Across the Nation. If you'd like to join our conversation, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495, or you can send us an email question, zestygarden@gmail.com. And Gretchen, I would imagine you can have chickens anywhere our listeners are, from St. George up to Soda Springs, Idaho. I mean, are there any limitations on elevation or where you wouldn't recommend as far as temperatures if they get too hot?
You know what? People keep them in all areas. Desert, high in the mountains, you have to make certain provisions in the mountains for winter care. I was tested. I went to Haley, Idaho, and did a class there. And those poor folks, you know, they have to use the snowblower to get to their coops. So we really, you know, figured out some great tips for them in terms of winter care. And there are certainly chickens that are more cold hardy than others. And those are the ones with the rose combs. So the combs that are more flat to the head as opposed to the peak combs and rose combs as opposed to the single combed girls. The Leghorns and the Rhode Island Reds have the single combs.
So did they just, genetics just went that way? If they've got a closer comb, then that they tend to have a little bit more buff?
No, actually more blood circulation too.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And so the tips of the comb, the very tops of the comb, are less likely to be frostbitten. With the single comb girls, they get the very tips frostbitten. And fortunately, in my book, and I'll sell it a little bit, I'm on Amazon, I'm in a lot of the bookstores as well, there's lots of tips and tricks to save money, to keep your flock alive. You know, that doing a 2x4 as a roost is another thing that keep your girls alive because they need that wide roost. I also have a wonderful homemade water heater that costs you a fraction of what they cost in the farm stores and easy to make, really easy to make. It involves eating a lot of popcorn. So there are lots of tips to keep those combs safe and the wattles safe as well.
Okay, so let's talk about water, mm-hmm. and how important that is for the chickens. How fresh should the water be? How often do you need to change it all the time? And you've got these 5-gallon waterers that, you know, if you only have a couple of chickens, that's a lot of water that could stick around for several days. Then it may not be the best.
Right. You want to be able to give them fresh water as often as possible, at least once a day. That's a lot of work. I started out with a 5-gallon waterer, and for me, frankly, it was so heavy. Once I would clean it out, fill it up every day, it was so heavy. So I went to a 2-gallon galvanized waterer, and they'll last a lifetime if you take good care of them. And now I'm going more toward chicken fountains and, oh, you smiled. Okay, you know about that.
Yeah.
Because that allows the chickens fresh water on demand. And if you have a water source, a chicken fountain is basically PVC pipe with what they call a chicken nipple attached to it. And think a hamster waterer. That's kind of what it is. But you hook it up to a hose, and you have fresh, clean water going through that PVC pipe. And no way of contamination. And the chickens teach themselves how to drink out of it, much like a hamster teaches themselves how to drink out of a hamster.
So how do you keep it from freezing in the winter?
There's certain, you know what, I have not had one through the winter. And I talked with Frank, the maker of the chicken fountain, and he said that there's a certain attachment you put on it, and it keeps it from freezing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I've thought about doing that, and I thought, well, but then the winter hits, and I've got to go back to dragging water back every day.
Yeah, and you know what? I'm glad you asked about water, because water is the number one nutrient for a chicken. You can buy them 20% protein manufactured food, maybe even non-GMO or organic, something like that, but it's actually water that is most important.
And why? Why is that?
They can go without food. They can go without food, but if they go without water for a day or so, you set them back in their development, especially when they're young, and then their egg development as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
As far as the food is concerned, so there are different concoctions that you can get. You can get organic. You can let them roam around. Mine tend to roam through the neighborhood. And the thing I've noticed, and I've checked with the neighbors to make sure that that's all right.
Sure.
But there are certain formulations of 20%, 16%. I don't know. I haven't bought the organic feed at this point, but they're out eating quite a bit from in the neighborhood. And I've noticed that the yolks are much darker yellow on my hands. And we sell eggs, and I have people tell me, your eggs have flavor. They actually taste good.
Oh, yes. Yes, there's a huge difference. And that's the exciting part about keeping backyard chickens. One, the yolks are almost a brilliant orange, and they're perkier. They sit up higher than a store-bought egg. And if you share eggs or you sell eggs, you might want to tell people who are just new to fresh eggs like that, that that's what they're going to find. I taught a class, and a gal said, I shared my eggs, and they threw them out. Because they didn't know that that's what they're supposed to look like.
They thought something was wrong.
Right, okay. Right. And as you notice, you know, in the summertime, your eggs turn more orange. In the wintertime, they lose that orange and they go more toward a yellow. And there are chefs around the world who actually have made out recipes for summer eggs versus winter eggs. So it's exciting. Also, Mother Earth News did a research project with Tufts University back in 2005, and they found that the store-bought eggs versus the free-range eggs that we get in our backyard chicken coops are off the chart healthy in terms of nutrients compared to one another. You can't get a fresher, better-for-you egg than something that you get from your backyard coop.
Well, we have our first caller. We have Amy from White Rocks, Utah, out in the Uinta Basin. Mm-hmm. Hi, Amy. Thanks for calling.
Hi,
how can we help?
How are you?
Great. Thanks for your calling.
I am living in an area in White Rocks, Utah that gets pretty cold in the winter.
Are you still there, Amy?
Amy.
I think we just... Are you back?
I am. I'm sorry. I'm probably... I get bad...
You get bad reception, obviously.
I do.
Amy, can you stop and stay in one place?
Okay, so I can hear you again. Go ahead.
Okay. So it gets really cold in the winter. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Really cold in the winter and really warm in the summer. And I've got a beautiful chicken coop. It's an older one, but it's probably 8 feet by 15 feet. But I'm wondering if I should buy chicks in the fall, if they'll be okay, and make it through the winter.
You want to make sure that they feather out before it gets really cold.
So they're at least pullet size?
Oh, yeah, 6 to 8 weeks is when they feather out.
Okay.
And so that starts their pullet development. And of course, they don't start laying eggs until, you know, they're 5 months old. So you have to time it right.
Would they need a heat lamp in order to keep them warm after the 8 weeks, or would we be okay if it hasn't started snowing?
Right. You should be fine. You should be fine. I never recommend a heat lamp in a coop.
It's a disaster. Recipe for disaster.
Oh, absolutely. I've seen so many coop fires. You just don't want to do that.
That's exactly what I was worried about. And then is there a better type of chicken that I should get for my circumstance?
You know, I like the Americana because they have a rose comb, I believe, if I'm right, or pea comb, one of the two. And it's just, or a shorter comb. So there's probably someone out there going, Gretchen, come on. Get your comb straight. And a Buckeye is a nice chicken, too.
Okay.
I was telling Brian, I love the Buckeye because, you know, you have chickens. We all have chickens, and they're great for natural pest control. But the Buckeye will go after a mouse before it gets a bug. So it's a natural mouser, and it's a fabulous chicken.
Great, because we live on 10 acres.
There you go.
And I just don't want something that, like, you know, like the leghorns, they're a little bit feisty and mean. So I'm trying to get something that's not mean, too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the Americana, and what was the other one?
Buckeye. Yes.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Thanks for your call.
Have a great day.
You too. Take care. If you'd like to join our conversation, it's 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. Or you can email us your question, zestygarden@gmail.com. I'm talking with Gretchen Anderson. She's author of The Backyard Chicken Fight, How Keeping Chickens in Your Yard is Ruffling Feathers Across the Nation. And so, Gretchen, how can people obtain the book? Just through Amazon?
Yeah, Amazon. I'm in a lot of Barnes & Noble. And, I'm doing... a little book signing and reading, and we're going to field questions at the King's English tomorrow.
In Salt Lake.
Yes. in Salt Lake on, is it 13th?
I think 13th South, I think.
Yeah, or somewhere, right there in Sugar House.
Yeah.
The King's English. It's a darling little bookstore. And we're going to be out on the patio. And so you can pick up the book there as well, and I'll be signing copies. And I loved, you know, what we find out is once you have chickens, you join this underground network of chickeners, you know, and everybody wants to talk about what kind of chickens you have and how well you do with which breeds and that sort of thing. And so we'll be talking all that stuff, and I'll tell all sorts of fun stories as well.
Or people in the neighborhood know you have chickens, so when they start to get chickens and decide, oh, this isn't the thing for them, all of a sudden...
Oh, is that what happened to
they,
you?
They bring chickens to you. Can you take these chickens? If they're a rooster, no. If it's a hen, sure, I'll consider it.
Sure, sure. Yeah. And, you know, there was a big article that just came out and hit nationally a few weeks back about don't keep backyard chickens unless you plan on butchering them, that sort of thing. And, you know, when I first started this whole thing out as an adult, and I got chickens so I could write the book because I had to write what I know, I didn't think I could butcher my chickens at all. Now,
that's where
Brian,
I am right now.
Oh no, Brian. Wait till one of those girls gets feisty with you and bites you. I could butcher a hen, absolutely.
Really?
Oh, hands down, yeah. Yeah,
okay.
Absolutely.
Because that's where I am. They're all named.
Sure.
Don't name your chickens.
Oh, yeah.
The kids are not going to appreciate you butchering them. But I just keep thinking, how am I going to do this? My grandma says, you just pick them up. She's from Arkansas.
Yeah.
Just pick them up and then you wring the neck.
That's
and I'm like,
right.
If I were to do that, I just know it would not kill the chicken. And then it'd be going, and then, so.
And then what do you do?
Yeah, then what do I do?
You rush it to the veterinarian.
And my wife has already told me, she said, Brian, I did this growing up. I'm not doing it now. It's going to be your job.
Oh,
so.
Yeah. You know, there was a hen, and quite often in backyard chickening, you can't have a rooster. So often, one hen will rise up to be the alpha hen. And I went in to scold one hen because she was being naughty, and that black sex link swooped in and bit me.
Wow.
And she went after me a couple other times, much like a rooster would do. And so that's when I knew it. Yep, butcher you out and use you as a put you in the stock pot. You know, the chickens that we eat in the store, the fryers that you see in the market, are 6 to 8 weeks old when they're butchered. They grow so rapidly. Meat hens, meat birds. So when you're talking about the potential of butchering a 3-year-old hen, you don't want to roast that hen or, you know, do fried chicken or anything like that. They are generally best for stewing. And though I have not done it yet, I've been told it's the best chicken soup you'll ever have. So what better way to honor that chicken, the one that bit me, right, with doing a wonderful dinner with chicken soup, maybe a New Year's dinner or something like that.
Could just
hear you
saying,
harvest dinner or something.
You bite me, I'm going to bite you.
Oh, yeah. Don't try it. But she was a little too aggressive.
Let's talk about then the regulations. What are you finding from municipality to municipality? I know that the rules are different from one to the next. I know in Hyde Park, I don't know if they even have any rules on the book. Mm-hmm. I do know since I had my chicken when I moved in, it kind of got grandfathered in with that. And
sure.
I've got roosters. And fortunately, my coop is at the back of the property and it's not right next to somebody's house, but I still, they crow all day long.
Yes. And roosters serve a purpose. You and I, you now, and I grew up on fertilized eggs. The number one misconception is you need a rooster to get eggs. You don't. The girls will lay regardless. But you do need a rooster for fertilized eggs, of course. And by and large, backyard chicken ordinances make a rooster a cock-a-doodle don't, is what we call it. A cock-a-doodle don't. And so, you know, the roosters are not wanted. So it's hens mostly. And it varies, Brian. It goes from, you know, two hens per yard in one municipality to up in Nampa and Caldwell, they said you could have 10 hens per yard, which is wonderful. In Boise, they just changed it last year from 3 to 6. Which is better, because 3 hens, you know, that's not a lot of eggs for a big family. So it varies. I'm pretty sure that Ogden, or at least the Ogden area, is still wrangling over roosters. Correct me if I'm wrong. And I want to say West Valley city had a, just put their foot down and said no way to backyard chickens, at least when I came in and taught classes. That's
so what are they afraid of? Are they just concerned that they want to make the city as open to everybody as possible, and they don't want to have to worry about the noise? They think they're going to be a mess? Because these hens do make, they announce that they've either laid an egg or they're going to lay an egg.
They cackle, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, but that's not happening all day long. That's just one time during the day.
Right.
It's not like a rooster crowing.
But you hit on two of the arguments. One is the noise. They think that the girls will be noisy. Nothing like a dog that yeah. barks. The decibel reading is probably half of what that is of a dog. And then two, the mess, the smell. And 3 to 6 backyard chickens don't smell very bad, especially if they're free-ranging. They're free-ranging. They're not smelling at all. It's when it gets, you know, cooped up and in one little area that it will start to smell. And if you're a poor steward to the land, then you shouldn't be keeping chickens. But most backyard chicken keepers I know are great stewards to the environment.
What would you recommend as far as going through the process? If you know that your rules in your town limit what you can do, what's the best way to approach the city council and the mayor to get them to change their mind?
Good question. You know, and I've talked to a lot of people who have gone through this process, and one fellow who did it down in Florida said, I would never enter into it like a city council meeting without knowing beforehand where everybody stood. And if I didn't have them all on my side, I wouldn't go and have the issue heard at that time. So I would say you lobby each individual council member and find out what their problem is and why they have issues with chickens. And often, Brian, it's because they grew up like you. There was a chicken that pecked them. Or they saw their grandma wring the necks of the chickens, or the chickens ran around and they had to clean out the coop. And so it was. So there's bad memories of nasty chicken environments. That's a far cry from a backyard chicken environment, because quite often the coops are darling. They're made to aesthetically fit into the backyard. And the chickens, you know, they're just back there foraging, getting the bugs, fertilizing, and just doing what chickens do. And it's a wonderful pastime. It's very entertaining just to sit and watch your chickens.
Can you train a chicken?
I've been told you can, and I've seen some video that you can. There are smarter chickens than others. My Americana, Hedwig, the house chicken, and I would never butcher her. Let's just put, I'm saying that for the record. She's very, very bright. And yeah, I think you can.
And is that some breeds just tend to be a little more clever than others?
Oh, yes.
Like my Campine.
Yeah.
No matter what I do to keep them in, she'll find a way out.
Right, right. A Lockenwelder, dumb as a box of rocks. You don't want to go there.
I had one of those ones.
Yeah.
And yeah, I agree.
Just not very smart, flighty. I don't recommend them, although they're fun to make fun of. So if you want one for, you know, humor relief, then yeah, get a Lockenwelder.
Well, and that's always fun, is looking through the catalog. Oh, a Lockenwelder. I wonder what that one's like, and order one just to get it to see what it's like. Because you don't usually find them in the farm stores. You have to get them special. And that's another whole conversation about ordering hens and
so and have them come in the mail.
Yeah,
and have the post office call you and say your peeps
at 5:30 in the morning.
Sure, they're peeping. Yep.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to come in. Thank you very much.
Oh, Brian, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
We've been listening to Gretchen Anderson. She's the author of The Backyard Chicken Fight, How Keeping Chickens in Your Yard is Ruffling Feathers Across the Nation, and A Beginner's Guide to Hen Keeping. And she's joined us today on The Zesty Garden. And if you happen to be in the neighborhood, we'll have you come back and we'll continue this conversation.
We could talk about winter care farther down the road, okay?
There we go. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
I have in studio with me Mike Coons. He's USU's Extension Forestry Specialist. And this is our first segment of Wait, Wait, Don't Plant That. And this is a segment that should help you in your gardening and what things to avoid planting in the landscape, because they just don't do well and there'll be more
headaches and problems than they're worth. So the first one that we're going to talk about is globe willow. And you see these all over the place. Yeah. Are they contractors that are putting them in?
No, I think people just think they're great looking, especially when they see them in the spring and nothing else is leafed out.
They come
and
out
those
early.
Those are bright green and big and full. They tend not to notice the ones that have half of the crown dead or one-third of the crown, the canopy. You know, and I hate to say never plant anything. I feel like there's got to be a place for anything, but the globe Navajo willow, I'm willing to say there's no place for it. And it's kind of a manufactured tree.
Okay, so it's not naturally occurring in the environment.
Well, certainly not in that it may not be grafted. I'm not sure. It may be grafted or it may be started with rooting cuttings, because willows, you can do that easily. But as far as I know, it may have occurred in one place. Somebody liked the look of it. They gathered cuttings from it and then propagated it, and now they've loosed it on the world.
I mean, it looks pretty. It looks like a globe. The way that the limbs come up, it's got this really nice rounded shape.
Right.
But beyond about the first couple of years, things start to happen, like a wind comes along and a huge branch gets ripped out, and
right.
Eventually it gets insects and diseases. And
yeah, for example, it's got aphids. Well, it doesn't have just any aphids. It has giant aphids, and it's got canker diseases, which all willows get, but I don't know that it gets them any worse than any other willow, actually. Willows are best kept along streams and lakes where they belong, because they need lots of water, and therefore there's not a lot of room for them in a typical residential landscape. There are some shrub willows that are appropriate, but almost any tree-size willow I can think of really isn't appropriate for most residential landscapes. Maybe if you had 10 acres and back in the back you've got a stream going by, sure, you'd want some willows.
So what would you suggest to replace it?
Well, assuming it's not that stream-side situation.
Right. So the same. So you're looking at, you'd like to have early flowers or early leafing. You want to have about the same shape, because these don't get all that tall.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of one that I still wouldn't plant. That's another willow. It's corkscrew willow. My aunt loves it, but it's just trashy looking after so many years. So
yeah, there's really not willows that are you're going to want in your yard other than shrubs. You know, silver maple leaves out early, but it's really problematic in Utah.
We might have that on our list later in
the
summer.
Yeah, it turns yellow all through the year because of our high soil pH. Almost anything. I mean, there are lots of good trees. You've looked at our Tree Browser website, just treebrowser.org, and there's all sorts of, actually, globe willows on that, because we have good and bad species on it. But there are a lot of good ones there. Leafing out that early, just the fact it is super early, there aren't really any trees coming to mind that come out that early.
So unless they're trees you don't want to plant.
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah. One really disgusting thing about it, I've got a dish on globe willow, is people will write or call asking about what they do about it's called slime flux that comes out of it. And it's this also comes out of Siberian elms sometimes. And it's bacterial wet wood is the kind of technical name for it. And it's a bacteria that gets inside, and then its byproducts get kind of pressurized because it produces so much of them, and it just oozes out of the wood, cracks in the bark and any wounds, and is just disgusting. It smells bad. insects are attracted to it. It runs down the tree and kills any vegetation you've got at the base of the tree, and there's really nothing you can do about it.
Is there no redeeming value to the is it the Navajo globe willow or willow?
Globe Navajo willow.
Globe Navajo willow.
I was going to say it sequesters carbon, you know, like carbon dioxide for helping with global climate change, but really it doesn't because it's so short-lived and the wood is so weak and decay-prone that it's probably releasing carbon dioxide from decay as fast as it's fixing it from photosynthesis. So I don't know that it'd be a good place to store carbon either. So no good reason.
So
But if you have one, enjoy it while you've got it. And in a while, you'll start losing branches.
So don't try to rehabilitate it. Just chop it down and start over with something else.
Yeah. You know, I'd be a lot sadder if I owned a beautiful weeping willow because those are so attractive and they last longer. But ultimately, they have the same problems that the globe willow has, weak wood and insect and disease prone.
So do not plant the globe Navajo willow.
Yes.
And that's our segment, Wait, Don't Plant That. Mike Coons is Extension Forestry Specialist at Utah State University. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
The UPR StoryCorps mobile booth recording project may have ended in St. George, but when the door to the StoryCorps booth closes, it means the door to UPR's production studio opens. And we are now listening to and editing stories that will be heard during a year-long series featuring interviews with your neighbors. Beginning in July, tune in to UPR on Thursdays and Fridays to listen to conversations recorded as part of this unique oral history project. Thanks to the City of St. George, the Riverwalk Grill, and Dixie Regional Medical Center for supporting the Utah StoryCorps project. And a special thanks to members of our UPR family for sharing stories that will last beyond our lifetime to be heard only on UPR, Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to the Zesty Garden. Coming in right now is another segment of Petals and Prose, and it's with Nancy Williams, and she's a journalism professor, journalism professor at Utah State University, and she's a beekeeper, and she's a wonderful person to have to come in the studio to read these. So you're going to hear a little bit about asparagus.
Historically, asparagus is pure sex food, writes Rebecca Rudd in her collection of delightful, curious but true stories about vegetables called How Carrots Won the Trojan War. Its renown as an aphrodisiac dates to antiquity and is derived from the undeniably penile shape of the emerging stalks, she writes, which pop suggestively out of the ground in early spring, just as a young man's fancy lightly turns to thoughts of love. Pliny the Elder, in his formidable 37-volume Natural History, written in 1st century CE, cites asparagus as a sex booster, as does the nearly legendary 2nd century Sanskrit sex manual, the Kama Sutra. In Western Europe, asparagus was touted among the remedies for the low-libido Renaissance man, along with prunes, garlic, nettle seed in wine, and dried fox testicles. In 19th century France, bridegrooms were fed three courses of asparagus in anticipation of their wedding nights, and the salacious stalks were banned from the menu in girls' schools for fear of inflaming the imaginations of susceptible teens. Despite, or perhaps because of, its propensity for provoking unbridled lust, people have been cooking asparagus at least since the time of the ancient Greeks and Romans. Ripe and ready for the pot, asparagus is pictured in murals on the walls of Pompeii, and Plutarch describes Julius Caesar feasting on asparagus in northern Italy, though somewhat unhappily, since his host had drenched the spears in myrrh instead of olive oil. As well as a vegetable Viagra, asparagus was touted as a specific for everything from congestive heart failure to kidney stones, Rebecca Rudd writes. According to Pliny, asparagus sharpened the eyesight and alleviated elephantiasis. It was also a preventive for pains in the chest and spine, a remedy for diseases of the intestines, a cure for jaundice, and the stings of serpents. And, Pliny reports solemnly, it is said that if a person is rubbed with asparagus beaten up in oil, he will never be stung by bees. The sad truth is that asparagus medically isn't good for anything much, though recent research from Korea's Cheju National University School of Medicine indicates that it may ease the miseries of hangovers. Asparagus extracts were found to increase the activity of crucial enzymes in the liver and expedite the metabolism of alcohol, suggesting that a hefty meal of asparagus should precede a binge at the neighborhood bar. Rebecca Rudd thinks the only real problem with asparagus is planting it. The planting instructions begin, "Dig a trench," she writes. Experts disagree as to the precise size of trench. Some recommend a relatively feasible 6-inch deep furrow. Others demand an excavation a foot deep and a foot and a half wide. And Martha Washington's Book of Cookery directs hopeful asparagus growers to, quote, "dig ye earth out a yard deep and fill up ye place again with old cow's dung," unquote. Still, a trench is a trench, and trench, face it, smacks of heavy labor, misery, mud, and World War I. Dig a trench is the dark side of gardening, the stuff of blood, sweat, back sprains, and blisters. That said, once you've dug your asparagus trench, you won't have to do it again for a good long time. Unlike most denizens of the vegetable garden, asparagus is a perennial. And the average asparagus bed, once established, will continue to produce asparagus spears for 20 to 30 years. Even better, asparagus isn't particularly picky. It adapts cheerfully to a wide range of circumstances and soils, and could even thrive, NASA scientists tell us, in the chilly red dirt of Mars. A sample of Martian soil, pinched up in 2010 by the robotic arm of the Phoenix Mars lander, was found to be mildly alkaline, with traces of magnesium, sodium, and potassium. Potentially fertile ground for diehards like asparagus and turnips, though future Martians might not be able to grow strawberries. The bottom line is that asparagus is one tough cookie. Beds can be started from seed, a long-term proposition, but a better bet is from crowns, which are the base and roots of 1 to 2-year-old plants. Even so, you won't have harvestable asparagus spears for at least 3 years, so be prepared. I'm sensitive to this, Rudd continues, having moved multiple times and left behind a cross-country trail of immature asparagus beds. In fact, I've become as suspicious of asparagus. Plant it and you'll move has been our rule to date, and we're awfully fond of where we're living now. Still, it's such a scrumptious vegetable that I hate to pass it up. And easy, too, once you get past the trench. The most environmentally friendly local eating undeniably comes from one's own backyard, she writes, which is why this season I'm going to dig an asparagus trench. Last summer, thanks to Pinterest, I discovered a simple and fabulous dish that uses fresh asparagus, fresh sage, and baby English peas. It serves 4 generously and takes a total of 35 minutes to prepare. Totally my kind of a recipe. This dish is the essence of early summer here in northern Utah, where asparagus is still in season and peas are just beginning. So delicious, too. You'll be able to find the recipe on the Zesty Gardens corner of the Utah Public Radio website tomorrow. Here it is. Penne with asparagus, sage, and peas. Here are the ingredients. You need 1/2 pound of penne pasta, 2 tablespoons extra virgin olive oil, 3 garlic cloves minced, 1 pound of thick asparagus cut into 1-inch lengths, 2 cups of chicken stock, 2 cups of shelled fresh peas, or a 10-ounce package of frozen baby peas thawed out, a quarter cup of heavy cream, 2 tablespoons of butter, 1 tablespoon of chopped fresh sage, and a half a cup of freshly grated Parmigiano-Reggiano cheese. Then salt and freshly ground pepper to taste. Here's what you do. Bring a large pot of salted water to a boil. Add the penne and cook until it's al dente. Drain. Meanwhile, in a large skillet, heat the olive oil. Add the garlic and asparagus and cook it over moderately low heat, stirring occasionally until the garlic is fragrant, or about 3 minutes. Add the chicken stock and boil over high heat until you've reduced it by half and the asparagus pieces are tender. That takes about 5 minutes. Now add the peas and cream to the skillet and boil over high heat until the sauce is thickened, another 3 minutes. Stir in the penne and cook until it's heated through. Remove it from the heat, stir in the butter, sage, and grated cheese. Season it up with salt and pepper. Transfer this wonderfulness to bowls and serve it right away, passing additional grated cheese at the table if you'd like. Bon appetit! Until next time, I'm Nancy Williams for The Zesty Garden.
Thank you to Nancy for that part of The Zesty Garden, and Nancy will be on in a couple of more weeks, and we'll be talking about raspberries. Now, to finish out the program, we've got our gardening calendar, so I'll begin with the Iron County Visitor Center, 581 North Main in Cedar City, is having a vegetable garden insect and disease management class. It's June 21st from 4 p.m. to 5:30 p.m. They'll discuss common insect and disease problems found in Iron County gardens. Participants will leave with knowledge needed to prevent and treat common garden problems. It's free, but all participants must register. For questions, call the USU Extension Office for Iron County at 435-586-8132. In Richmond, they are having their harvest market at Rock Hill. It's June through October on Saturdays from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. And it goes through the middle of October or whenever they get snowed out. Spaces are only $5 a day if you would like to sell your own items, and they accept grown vegetables and fruits, meats that have been inspected by USDA and packaged according to state regulations, fresh eggs, and foods prepared under a cottage kitchen permit. Contact Terry at 770-9061 or Pete at 258-1278 for more information. Wasatch Mountain State Park in Midway, Utah, is having a class, the Utah Master Naturalist Mountains class. It's Thursdays in June from 3 to 8 p.m. and Saturdays in June from 9 to 2. Some of the greatest ecological diversity and scenic beauty in Utah exists in the forest and alpine environments. And throughout these ecosystems, temperature, elevation, and precipitation play an important role in defining plant and animal communities and their interactions. Come join the class while they explore these systems, learn about how they function, the plants and the animals that live there, and how they are managed. And just search online under Wasatch Mountain State Park. And then there's a plant propagation series at the Utah State University Botanical Center. It's their series 2. It's going to be through the summer, basically, through July 18th. On Thursday, July 18th at 9 p.m., the first of a 5-part series. This class includes starting your own bedding plants and vegetables from seed, growing them from planting in your garden and landscape. Registration and fees include seeds, soilless media, containers, and labels. So the things that they'll be talking about now will be what to grow toward the end of the season. The phone number is 801-593-8969. Thank you for joining us on this edition of Zesty Garden, and we'll be back next week at 10 o'clock.
This is folk singer Michael Jonathan inviting you to the next Wood Songs broadcast. It's all about using music in your community. We have Ken Waldman from Alaska, the great songwriter Cy Conn, and Grammy Award winner Tom Chapin.
Do if it's the last trip home. This could be the last trip home.
It's music and conversation on the next broadcast of the Wood Songs, Old Time Radio.
The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. You're listening to Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.